Good morning. I want to call this meeting of Safety Committee to order. We're going to start off with a safety contact from Mr. Pat Lavin, our Chief Safety Officer. Pat?
In the event of an emergency, we're going to egress through the main doors or through the closest exits located behind me, illuminated with an exit sign. We're going to assemble on the lawn at the National Building Museum. AEDs are located at the guard station. Fire extinguishers are strategically placed throughout the building. Restrooms are past the guard desk on the left. Today is the Great American Smokeout. Every year on the third Thursday of November, which is today, smokers across the nation take part in the American Cancer Society Great American Smokeout event. By quitting even for one day, smokers can take an important step towards a healthier life and reducing their cancer risk. Within minutes of smoking your last cigarette, your body begins to recover. 20 minutes after quitting, your heart rate and blood pressure drop. 12 hours after quitting, carbon monoxide level in your blood drops to normal. 2 weeks to 3 months after quitting, your circulation improves and your lung function increases. 1 to 9 months after quitting, coughing and shortness of breath decreases. 5 years after quitting, your risk for cancer is cut in half and your stroke risk falls to that of a non-smoker. These are just a few of the benefits of quitting smoking. Thank you and good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. We have an agenda ahead of us. Any objections to the agenda? Hearing none, the agenda is adopted. We also have minutes from the October 26, 2017 meeting. I have a motion to adopt the minutes. Second? All in favor?
Mr. Chair, could you just record show that I abstained on that since I was not here at the October 26th.
Okay, absolutely. Okay, the minutes of October 26, 2017 are approved. Thank you, everyone. Good morning. We have two items on our agenda for today. I'm going to give you a brief overview of each. Our first item is an update on the National Transportation Safety Board and Federal Transit Administration FTA Corrective Action Plans, or CAPS. The board's going to receive a progress report on implementing these safety recommendations. And next, Mr. Lavin will update the committee on enhancements to the roadway worker protection that ensures the safety of workers out inspecting or working on the Metro Rail right-of-way. Today's briefing will highlight the enhancements made to the program since the committee's last update in June. We're going to add one other item to the agenda at the beginning. I asked Mr. Lavin to give us an explanation of one of the issues that has occurred recently that we've read about in the press, and this is the incident where we had a worker who was burned by third rail, I believe, in Falls Church. Mr. Lavin, can you give us a little bit of information on that incident?
Sure. Chris, can you put up the slide, please? All right, so before I get into the narrative, it'd probably be useful to explain what the picture is depicting. So essentially, the third rail in that area is fed from three different substations, which are denoted in blue. On the left-hand side, you have breaker 32, and if you look below it, you'll see a red line that indicates that in this incident, the third rail was energized and had not been turned off. In the center is Ogden Street Breaker House, where you had breakers 42 and 44. Those were offline because they were being upgraded for estate of good repair purposes. On the right-hand side, you have West Falls Church Substation, breaker 54. That breaker was removed by the Rail Control Center in an attempt to establish a supervisory power-off area, which was not done correctly. The green lines denote the area where the actual work was occurring between those two green lines. Okay, I'm going to now get into the narrative to explain what occurred. On Tuesday, October 31st, 2017, a six-person track maintenance crew were assigned to install two 39-foot pieces of rail on track two between West Falls Church and Dunloring stations on the Orange Line. Upon the roadway worker in charge requesting track access, the ROC controller initiated a supervisory power outage to support the track work. However, after calling for power off within the work zone limits, a section of the third rail remained energized unbeknownst to the ROC controller. Contributing to this event was a temporary power configuration at the Ogden Street tiebreaker station, in which tiebreakers 42 and 44 were removed from service for overhaul purposes. As a result of this temporary power configuration, physical third rail jumpers were installed in the field to bridge the third rail gap between a live third rail fed by breaker 32 located at Dunloring Station and a portion of the third rail affected by the Ogden Street substation being offline. So if you look in the picture on the left-hand side, you see red dots, those are the jumpers that were physically tying across that power gap. In this instance, the removal of third rail power with the entire work zone would have required both breaker 32 at Dunloring and breaker 54 at West Falls Church to be opened. However, the process used by the controller, i.e., clicking on a horizontal line depicting the third rail, only opened breaker 54, and a section of third rail continued to be fed by breaker 32. So when you're at the desk as a controller, you can click on a line that represents the third rail. Under normal conditions, that opens all the breakers that are in control of that section of third rail. Because of this configuration, the power didn't come off. The ROC informed the RIC that third rail power was de-energized, and he began securing the work area utilizing exclusive track occupancy as the crew's form of roadway worker protection. The RIC confirmed power was de-energized in the section of third rail controlled by breaker 54 by hot sticking prior to commencing work. So the initial work area was in the gray area. That's where the first rail was being installed. They hot sticked there, and the third rail was dead. I'm sorry, I just lost my spot for a second. Upon installing equipment, shunts, lights, and the end of work mats to secure boats under the work area, the track maintenance team began installing the first rail section at approximately 1:45 a.m. This activity occurred without incident, and work crew moved further downstream to the next location where rail replacement was required. The second piece of rail was set in place. However, at 3:30 a.m., a Trist employee sustained an electrical burn while attempting to tighten a bolt on a joint bar with a hydraulic impact wrench that had bridged the live third rail and the adjacent newly installed running rail. The RIC contacted the ROC and reported that power was still energized. At 3:37 a.m., the ROC controller instructed the RIC to stand by as he opened breaker 32 and de-energized the section of third rail where the track maintenance team was working. The employee was initially transported for medical care for a non-life-threatening injury and was subsequently released from the hospital Thursday, November 2nd, 2017. No other employees sustained injuries. The preliminary findings reveal that RWP rules governing confirming power off within the work zone was not followed, i.e. the proper use of WSAD and not hot sticking at each power gap. The ROC controllers did not follow the correct process removing power for the temporary power configure operation at Ogden Street Station. There was no physical barrier, i.e. electrical safety mat, was used as a redundant form of protection to shield the employee from the third rail, and the hydraulic impact wrench had electrically conductive lead hoses that came into contact with the energized third rail. The following actions have been taken since this incident. Power performed a visual inspection of the third rail as well as operational field testing and verification. There are no anomalies with the third rail. The use of the hydraulic impact wrench used in this incident has been suspended. The WSAD and hot stick that were used in the event by the RIC have been verified to be working as designed. SAFE developed and issued safety bulletin 1711, which is called Additional Precautions for Work Performed Under Supervisory Power Outages, with an emphasis on the new requirements to hot stick at the immediate work location, hot sticking when repositioning with the work area, and requiring the use of a physical barrier, an insulated mat, plywood, or protective board, etc., when incidental contact with the third rail may occur. Trist has developed a 10-day action plan to include increased work site audits, a review of a redundant third rail barrier protection sources at sister properties. I know they went up to New York to see what was being used there. Job hazard analysis with contractor assistance, prioritizing rail replacement as one of the first analyses to be conducted, and instructed management supervision in all level four RICs on the safety bulletin previously mentioned. Trist will be conducting safety stand downs on November 16th, 15th, and 16th with all personnel that emphasize the following topics: the importance of proper RWP setup, the new procedures for working under supervisory power outage, requirements on material use and barrier devices, loading and securing materials, tools, and equipment on prime movers and flat cars. The ROC conducted a safety stand-down detailing the correct procedures in de-energizing third rails in areas where there are reconfigurations, as well as issued the lessons learned. ROC modified procedures governing de-energizing, reconfiguring traction power substations that requires controllers to utilize the power schematic screen to command breakers. So they cannot click on a line now. They're required to go into an actual screen and open the breakers. The substations that are removed from service will have Ames graphics modified with a different color and a lightning bolt depicted on the screen to elevate awareness of the condition. i.e. if we have a traction power station that's trumped out, it'll now have a lighting bolt on it on the AIM screen, so you're aware that there's an additional hazard that needs to be addressed. The ETA for implementing the AIM change is early December. And this incident, the investigation is still ongoing.
Thank you, Mr. Lau. This, you know, resulted in an injury to an employee, but it could have been a lot worse. And this really is indicative of how important it is to follow the policies and procedures that are in place. And I guess if there's one frustration that we've all seen with Washington Metro is there's many instances of failures to follow the procedures that are put in place to protect both the public and the workers. And this is yet another example. So we'll look forward to a more detailed report on how we're correcting this issue and how we're providing oversight to make sure that these procedures are being followed consistently. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Mr. Lehman, I'm just trying to make sure I understand it. The thrust of your explanation seemed to be human error, that it was a problem with faulty action by either a controller or people on the track in the World River Protection Area. But I just want to clarify, was the screen that the controller looking at show clearly that the right-hand section was deactivated, and did it at the same time show that the middle section was still activated?
The way the system works is that when you click on the button to open the breaker, it only tells you the breaker is open. It doesn't confirm the status of the third rail. So if you were at another property, i.e. New York, we would have two things. We would tell you that the breaker was open, and then we would monitor the energy on the third rail, and it would tell you that it's dead on backfeed at the adjacent substation. You don't have that feature here. So when they click on it, it just tells you that the breakers have been activated. It doesn't confirm the status of the third rail. That's why they have to hot stick in the field to confirm it.
So was there something that the controller should have done and didn't do?
Yes.
And what was that again?
There are written instructions on the desk that tell you that this location has been reconfigured. There's a process for the reconfiguration, which would have required that they go into a different screen and physically, manually open a breakers, which has been reinforced now. And to make it more aware to the controllers, we're now putting anywhere where one of these substations are, and it comes up on the screen, you'll see a lightning bolt, so you know there's a reconfiguration.
And that's supposed to signal to the controller that he should look at the second screen or that additional screen.
It's an additional reminder that they should be doing that going forward.
Thank you.
I'd be interested in your thoughts on this situation, since you have more expertise. Is this unusual that we don't have a redundancy situation that Michael was talking about?
I wouldn't say that it's unusual that we don't have this redundancy. You know, the policies and procedures are built to provide these redundant protections. Depending on what property you're on, there's different procedures. The point from at least from my experience is that policies and procedures that are put in place protect the workers are critical, and if they're not followed, you're at risk. And I think this is another example of that. Mr. Dorsey, you had a question.
I did. Thank you. So it's a great thing that the worker didn't suffer more extensive injuries. So I'm just curious as to, you know, aside from the systems and what happened with the rock and what we do or do not have technologically in place, the use of a hot stick seems to a layman's perspective kind of common when you're working around live voltage. So do you have any sense in this case as to why that wasn't sort of used to further sort of protect against this sort of thing from happening? Is it just that these are so rare that people sometimes get laxed, or was there not access to a hot stick to perform this work? Can you just talk a little bit more about why the choice of the tool was used as opposed to something that presumably would be much safer and would have prevented this injury?
I believe the issue in this case was complacency.
Okay.
Because the individual had hot sticked in the section of rail that was dead, because that was the first location that they did the rail replacement. When they moved downstream, I believe his assumption was, as well, if it was dead here, it must be dead here.
Yes, sir.
Patrick, I have just a general question. Once the investigation is finished, how is it communicated back to the employees responsible, or is it?
Well, we're doing the stand downs now, so they'll understand what happened initially. Okay. The final report when we come out will have recommendations. But in addition to this, we also notified VOSH, so it's posted now in all the employee facilities what occurred. Okay. So there is a communication back to the employees.
And then will there be a review of training or recertification type of efforts as well as a response to this?
Or? Yes, and what we're contemplating now is I'm going to embed safety officers on a midnight tour when most of this work is occurring. We're developing a defined checklist that we're going to audit against. So I've been discussing this with Mr. Lita. He's going to support me in this. And then we're going to audit against a defined set of parameters with now it's going to be announced visits. We'll tell Rick we're coming out there to get compliance up. Probably after 90 days, we're going to start doing unannounced audits.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any more questions? Seeing none, let's move on with the agenda.
So this is an update on FDA and NTSB actionable items. I'd like to present our progress on outstanding safety actions coming from findings and recommendations from the Federal Transit Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board. The data presented today represents close of business October 27, 2017. Therefore, the data on our website will reflect additional FTA actionable items that are closed. There have been 299 corrective action plans assigned to WMATA by the NTSB and oversight entities. The CAPS can be divided into three separate categories. The FTA SMI CAPS, which were a result of a system-wide inspection that was conducted in the spring of 2015 by the FTA. The FTA WMATA oversight CAPS are those that have been assigned as part of the FTA's oversight capacity. These CAPS are embedded in the FTA directives, of which five have been issued. These directives have resulted in 177 CAPS. The final group of CAPS that have been assigned are by the NTSB. There are 31 CAPS in this group. 102 of the 299 have been closed in the past 2 years. 197 remain open. The CAP closures have contributed to the progress on improving areas such as preventive and corrective maintenance, policies and procedures, training and record keeping. The status of each CAP is posted on our online for tracking and review on our website, and the website page is there. Each CAP may have numerous actionable items associated, i.e. for a single CAP, you could have 5 or 6 actionable items. The 299 CAPs resulted in 1,283 actionable items. Of the current 1,283 actionable items, 539 have been approved and closed. 501 have been submitted for approval and closure, and the remaining 243 are in development. Two NTSB CAPs have been closed this year. Both of them have been closed as closed acceptable. They were R1022, which was the development of a program to monitor railcar event recorders. The second one was R1508, which was to assess the state of good repair of tunnel ventilation systems in accordance with industry best practices. There are 29 open NTSB CAPs. 14 CAPs have been submitted to the NTSB and currently under review. 15 CAPs are currently in development or are open. The slide reflects the areas that have been submitted as well as those under development. Our central focus is making the required improvements to the system to ensure the safety of our employees and customers. We are already working on improving the system through track work and other maintenance actions. New enhanced training is under development. Rules and procedures are being examined and revised where required, and vital assets are being prioritized under the new capital needs inventory. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Lavin, for that report. There seems to be an awful lot of these CAPs that are open. Should we be concerned about the number of open CAPs? In other words, are there critical safety issues that are not being addressed?
Well, the most critical one in my mind is NTSB R0804, which is classified as an unacceptable risk. Right, that is the one to do with RWP protection, which is why we're rolling out the RWP program. So we are prioritizing the most important risk first, and we're taking actions to address them.
So we have a lot of them caps that have been submitted, at least the WMATA's corrective action plan. Once you make a submission to NTSB or FTA, how long does it take to get an answer back on whether that's acceptable or not?
Okay, so if you look at the time frame for the NTSB, it takes approximately 178 days for the NTSB to respond back to us. On average, it takes the FTA approximately 116 days.
Thank you. We have other questions? Let me start with Mr. Goldman.
Thanks,
Mr. Bolger.
We've had these reports, Patrick, every quarter. What would be helpful to me, based on Bob's questions, is from quarter to quarter, how well are we closing these outstanding situations or caps?
Okay.
From last time you reported to the committee to now.
I can get you.
You know, so we could see a progress.
I'll
or you tell us that we're stuck with the number of days that you just described in NTSB and FTA.
Yeah, what I'll do is I'll get back with my staff and I'll lay it out quarter by quarter what the progress is, so you can do some type of comparison over time.
I think the committee would be happy with that kind of a metric.
Thank you. I'd like to agree, but if I could just add further, I think this conversation gives us the issue that looking at open versus closed is maybe not the most useful metric. It's what we have submitted and, where it stands in the process, because clearly with, 6 months being possible for something to get an answer from the agencies, it's not necessarily reflective of the progress that we're making, whether it's closed or not.
Goldman, do you have a question?
Yes, I did. Pat, the slide that reads open NTSB caps,
right.
And there's 29 there. This is the total universe of NTSB caps that were recommendations made to WMATA. Is that correct?
Well, the total universe was over 100. We're down to 29.
Correct.
Yes.
And the difference between the two groups is that the first group, because it's not clear from your language, but I think it's clear from what you said in presenting it, that the first group, the first 14, are now at NTSB waiting for them to approve those caps. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what's not clear to me was what's the status of the other 15 that are open. Okay. They are not at NTSB at this point in time?
That's correct. And let me elaborate on that if you don't mind. So, for example, we have a cap that says that we need to put signage at locations where routes either come together or diverge. So in order to fulfill that cap, we had to go to local jurisdictions, show them the type of signage we want to use. We had to get their concurrence that this is the appropriate signage. Then we had to go out, so I believe it was something like 13 locations, install the signage. Then we documented that all the signage is installed, and now we create all that. And I believe that cap is probably going within the next 2 weeks to the NTSB. So just because they haven't been submitted, a lot of these could be very far downstream. I'd just like to comment on something Mr. Dorsey said and to Mr. Bolger. Some of these cap closures could take, over multiple years. For example, if they tell you the NTSB recommends get rid of the 1K cars, then you have to come up with a design for the 7K, you have to come up with the funding, you have to now implement it. So just one cap that could linger for years doesn't mean we're not progressing on it. So you kind of have to balance that when you look at the numbers.
I guess just a comment, Patrick. I think the committee would be happy to know, what are the ones that are going to take forever, and what are the ones that are, normal pedestrian. So that we don't lump them all together, because I'm looking at these charts and they're all lumped together. I can't tell the priority, which is, sorry, Michael.
Sorry. So just coming back to the 15 that are still open, I assume these either came out of the NTSB report on the 2009 Ford Totten or the 2015 L'Enfant Plaza smoke incident. Are they all from the 2015 NTSB report on the smoke incident at L'Enfant Plaza, or do some of these go back to the 2009 Fort Totten?
One of them goes back to RWP, which is actually predates Fort Totten, which I think came out, and that recommendation actually came out in 08. So that, but the ones that are from the L'Enfant fire, I think that's predominantly probably 80 to 90% of them. I think it's only one or two that predates the Lafont fire.
And why are they still, quote, open after 8 or 9 years at this point? What's the impediment to coming up with an action plan that we can present to the NTSB and get these off the books?
Okay, so the one for the that's been open for since 2008, the technology really didn't exist in the industry. So the NTSB recommends that we come up with a bidirectional system that, you know, communicates between the train and the worker, which I'm going to brief out on. If that technology doesn't exist in the industry, then we can't implement it. So the industry technology needs to catch up before we can start acting on that cap.
Can I just one more question? It's a slightly different area. Could you give us an update on where we are on implementation of the Metro Rail Safety Commission machinery, and what happens to these caps when the Metro Rail Safety Commission comes into existence? Do they all transfer to the MSC, or does the FTA retain an oversight responsibility for directives that it's issued prior, you know, while it's the supervisor of the...
Okay, so that's a little bit out of my lane, but I'll understand that.
It's okay.
I understand the... Ms. Fist is here from the FTA. We meet every 2 weeks and discuss things. So eventually there's going to be a transition period where we could have the FTA, the TOC, and the MSC all together until we do the handoff. But I think the goal is at the end of the day is the FTA is going to get out of the WMATA oversight business, and then it's going to turn over to the MSC.
So that we will, at that point, only be oversight by the MSC, and any pre-existing caps will become caps for the MSC to supervise?
That is my belief, yes.
And do you have a timetable for that?
I
know this is out of your lane.
I do not.
All right, we'll return to that, and I think at least the Safety Committee will probably have a hearing on where we are on the MSC at some time.
Yeah, we'll be following up on that, I think.
I think so, too.
One final question, Mr. Bulger.
Well, not to do your agenda, Mr. Chairman, but I think that's a good agenda item. Because, you know, months ago there was all this noise about standing up the safety organization, and then we haven't heard anything. And Michael's good questions are a good one, because my understanding is the new safety, and help me out, Bob, they're going to have a lot more power, a lot more authority. And it, I think, would be good, the board should know, the committee should know how that's going to play out, when they're going to stand up, how it's going to be funded, how they're going to hire people to do all this stuff, et cetera. So.
Well, at this point, just my little bit of knowledge about what's going on. There's a lot of moving pieces that still have to be in place. There's additional staff that has to be selected. There's funding. There's a lot of things that have to happen, and it's moving forward from what I understand from briefings that I've received. Some people have been selected to serve in that capacity, but not all the folks that will provide that oversight function have even been identified at this point or hired. So as those things happen, I expect that the Safety Committee will get more and more briefings on what it's going to look like and how it's going to operate.
Well, can I add to that, Mr. Chairman? It's my understanding that DOT is still withholding funds all the way down the Tidewater. Is that still the case with
yes.
the fact that this
yes.
agency hasn't? Okay, so that's almost, Christian, a year or more?
Over yes.
a year that funding has been held up. So I would add that to the discussion about what's going on.
I mean, just to reinforce, Mr. Lobby, there is progress. I know at least in Virginia that the members of the Safety Commission have been designated, and once that's all done from the jurisdictions, they'll then have to select a director, then the organization will be officially stood up, and then it will begin all of these things that Pat discussed in terms of figuring out what the handoff is, and then hopefully at that point it'll satisfy what DOT requires to release the funds. But my understanding jives with Mr. Lobby that we're not at a point yet where we can have a Safety Committee conversation about that until all of that initial work is done.
And it's my understanding that Virginia is the only one that has selected those.
No, Maryland
has also? Okay. Okay.
But we were first, so I thank you for pointing that out.
Okay. So anyhow, that organization has to be stood up. It has to be approved by FDA, and then I think at that point we're clear to talk about some of these other issues. All right. In the interest of time, let's move on to the next item, which is roadway worker protection. Mr. Lavin.
Protection. Today's discussion will cover the FTA ProTran grant that is meant to address NTSB cap R0804. The cap will monitor to develop bidirectional technical solution that will notify train operators of the presence of wayside workers and to alert wayside workers of the presence of oncoming trains. In addition, the vehicle awareness technology progress will be reviewed along with an interim roadway worker protection enhancements that have been recently implemented. The technology behind the ProTran grant is a bidirectional system that adds another layer of protection. The system works by having the roadway workers wear a personal alert device on their arm that activates the roadway box units as they walk by. So Bob asked me to bring some show and tell. So these are essentially the alarm that will be on a band that the employees wear on their arm. They'll interface with a box such as this. So as I'm walking by, this box will trigger, it'll give you a flashing light and an audible alarm. When we get into the fixed work site, I'll explain the other box. So what happens is as the employee walks, it alerts this, makes the box flash, an approaching train sees the flashing light, so it's the bidirectional communication. When the train reaches the box, there's a sensor on the box that detects the train, and it triggers the audible and visual alarm on the armband. Finally, this technology will also include a location awareness function, which will allow roadway worker locations to be tracked and remotely identified. So this is some degree of an employee performance monitoring tool. Critical hotspots have been identified. These spots are representative samples of the hazardous track conditions that are present throughout the system. So they include things like turbulent vortexes, blind curves, and no clearance areas. 13 locations have been selected. 184 roadway box units will be deployed at these locations. These units will be used to send the signals between the roadway worker and the oncoming trains. Finally, 178 armbands have been obtained as part of the grant. Several progress milestones are being monitored. Preliminary proof of concepts were conducted between National Airport and Braddock Road in April of 2017. Installation of the roadway box units will begin in the remaining locations starting in December of 2017. Training of armband use will occur for all users in July of 2018. The equipment is scheduled to be fully installed and operational by August of 2018. That is just for the pilot. The function of the vehicle awareness system is to mitigate accidents by informing rail vehicle operators of the distance of the closest vehicle in front and behind them in real time, with accuracy up to plus or minus 3 feet. This system is to be used for Class 2 roadway maintenance machines only. It is intended just for Class 2 vehicles. This is not for Class 1 revenue cars. This is so you don't have two prime movers crash into each other. When used within a work block, the system will alert the equipment operator of the start of the work zone. So essentially what you do is this box gets installed at each end of the work zone. It's magnetic. It goes into the lip of the rail. These two sensors pick up a train wheel as it goes by. Within the work zone, you have one of these boxes, or you have the armbands. If a prime mover shows up at the limit of the work zone, it's detected, it triggers the audible alarm, and it triggers the armbands. I can turn it on for you, but it's very loud.
Well, maybe we should hear.
Oh, goodness. Trust.
Cover your ears. Give us a warning.
Currently with the RMMs, the units are on property, they're ready to be installed. The test plan is currently under development. This plan will identify the final scope and success parameters of the project. The hazard analysis is also being conducted concurrently, and this is to ensure that no greater hazards are being introduced as part of the pilot program. The project, it is projected that the technology will be fully deployed sometime in the third quarter of fiscal year 2018, so this is on the prime movers. Finally, interim RWP enhancements have been implemented while the technology-based pilot projects are being designed and tested. As we discussed at an earlier committee meeting in June, the advanced mobile flagger process has been fully adopted. This process deploys a worker at each station that precedes the mobile work crew that is on the right-of-way. The worker stops the train when it enters the station and warns the operator of the work crew ahead. This invokes several actions, which is a reduction in speed in the train, the blowing of the horn, and being prepared to stop when they see right-of-way workers. A survey of the rail system was recently completed. This survey reviewed all of the track hotspots, which are high-hazard areas for roadway workers. These hotspots require special precautions, such as foul time to pass through the area. Other bulletins have been developed that touch on communication issues. RW permanent orders are being reviewed and updated. The RWP handbook is also integrated into the Metro Rail Safety Handbook. This will reduce any confusion of having only one roadway worker rule book. Currently, there's three, so we're going to get down to a pocket guide and its SOP. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Lavin. Sounds like a lot of progress has been made. I've got two questions. One, as far as the ProTrans system, this is a pilot program here at Washington Metro. Is this system in place and operational at other properties around the country or the world?
Yes, it is. I know they use it in Baltimore, and they also use it at, I believe it's being introduced at SEPTA, and I believe it's also being introduced at LA Metro.
So our pilot program is to see how it works with the infrastructure and the system that we have here in Washington, correct?
Right. It has to work in our operating environment.
Okay. And my next question has to do with the mobile station platform flagging procedures that you have in place. This has been in place for quite a while now. Can you give us just an indication of how that's working? Is there confidence that this procedure is providing the protection we want? Do the roadway workers like it? Do they feel comfortable with these policies and procedures that you have in place for mobile flagging?
So most of the feedback I've gotten has been predominantly positive. There still are issues of nonconformance, which will also be part of the auditing process. So any system is only as good as the employees who are conforming to the system. So you're not immune from all these incidents, but I believe it has greatly enhanced safety.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Dorsey.
Thank you. A couple quick questions. So this is all very promising, and I hope the pilot bears fruit. In the event that it does, is the investment in instituting this across the system, is this a big lift in terms of capital expense, and how long does this technology last? With the life cycle?
I'll answer the ones I can answer.
Okay.
Okay. So the thought is that if the pilot is successful, then we'll roll it out to an RFP to the street and put it out there for bid. Our strategy would be to install this at every 800 feet at blue light locations. And the reason we want to do that is a variety of reasons, because we have some areas where we could have two levels, like Metro Center or Gallery Place, where we don't want, you know, information bleeding across lines and creating confusion. That would take a huge capital investment. I don't know what that cost is at the moment.
Okay.
And the life expectancy of the equipment would be determined, you know, that's part of the piloting to see what the failure rate is.
Okay. And, you know, this is all perhaps very premature, but hopefully we're considering the issues. In order for this to truly be an enhancement, people can't become dependent on the technology at the expense of some of the procedures that are already in place. So are we sort of thinking about how to make sure we don't just have a shift in this and therefore it not being a technological enhancement, but something that becomes a crutch that could provide issues if it ever fails?
It's always a concern in every aspect. But I agree with your thinking. We need to address it.
Thanks.
Just an extension of that is how much were employees involved in making the selection of this equipment to transfer their skills that they were using to dependency on this?
So when we initially did the proof of concept at National Airport, we had union leadership come out with us, and they gave us very positive feedback. So I think we have the buy-in from the union.
Who makes the technology, Pat?
Currently, it's ProTran, but I believe there are also other vendors out there that have similar products.
Okay.
Yes, just two mechanical questions. How are the armbands recharged?
So there's a bank, I actually have it upstairs, where you can charge five at a time. So they're rechargeable, and then before you go out to the field, there's a device where you can test it. So you test it in the room before you go out there to verify it's working. And there's also, if the battery starts to fail, it goes into a failure mode where it constantly chirps, so you know the battery's going dead.
And the amber lighting on the box that is notifying the train drivers, can that lighting be confused with any other notification lights that are on the track bed?
It would also, the only other flashing yellow you would have would be the amber light that's used by the AMF, which would invoke a speed restriction anyway. Our signals are red and white, so that shouldn't be confused with the signal aspect.
Thank you.
Member?
Have you talked to the other jurisdictions that are implementing or are currently using the system and what's their compliance been and any issues, costs, things like that?
Okay, so one of our employees actually came from Baltimore. He's familiar with the product. He gave it rave reviews. So he's been familiar with it. He says the compliance rate there is very high, and they haven't had any near misses or roadway incidents since they implemented it.
Okay. But you haven't personally reached out to anyone yet?
No, I've talked to people at SEPTA who I know who are looking at it because they actually had a couple incidents there that were, high-profile incidents. So
Thanks,
Ben. Any other questions on this? All right, hearing none, I just want to say this will be the last meeting of the Safety Committee because we have restructured the committees, and the Safety Committee is going to be joined with many of the issues up from the Customer Service Operations and Security Committee, and so we have a new committee name, Safety and Service Delivery Committee, and in the future those subjects will be combined into an agenda for a Safety and Service Delivery Committee meeting next month in December. With that, can I have a motion to adjourn? Second? All in favor? Committee stands adjourned.